Now, last week we started talking about God's eternality or his infiniteness, and we got to a stopping point, and we're going to pick up where we left off. We're going to be looking at the idea of God operating inside time. Again, this goes back to concepts that are a bit difficult to understand, but we do know that God exists outside of time. However, when we look at Scripture, we can see that God does also operate inside time. Let's just look at some examples of God operating in time. Well, we can just go to Genesis 1, and I'm not going to read the whole chapter. I'm just going to summarize this. In Genesis 1, what happened? God created the heavens and the earth, and then the list of days. And they summarize to go like this. Day 1, light. Day 2, sky versus water. He separated the sky versus the water on the ground. Day 3, land, seas, vegetation. Day 4, sun, moon, stars. Day 5, fish and birds. Day 6, land animals and mankind. And day 7, he rested. But in each of these, after he created something, it says the evening and the morning were one day. Day first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh day. So we have God doing something. First, we have God creating time itself. In Genesis 1:1, God created time itself. As we learned from last week, that when God created everything, he created matter, space, and time. That's what makes up all of creation. He created all of that out of nothing. So he created time in Genesis 1:1. And then on each day, God created various things, which means God had to operate inside of time. But he also had to exist before time existed, so he exists outside of time. Now, a bit of a side note here. It's very interesting when you look at this. On day one, God created light. So, the source of light on the earth is a big old burning ball of gas that we call the sun, and it radiates light down onto earth. Now, here's the interesting part. Day one, God created light. Day two, created something else. Day three, created something else. Day four, the sun and the stars and the moon. So for day one, day two, and day three, we have light, but no sun. Now, the argument for this is that the light is referring to some other source of light. And my question would be, on earth, what source of light in the universe, in the natural world? Light of the world, but what's the source of our light? Well, it's not a light bulb. It's the sun is one option. Stars are another. Well, what about the moon? Well, that doesn't work because the moon is created also on day four. Besides, the moon is just a reflection of the sun's light. So we have light existing for days with no natural source of light. I would argue this. The source of light on day one, two, and three was God himself. That's the only source that existed for light. Now, an evolutionist would say, well, this is metaphor. It's not literal days, and so therefore, and my answer is, and the reason I support a young earth and a literal seven-day creation is because when you look at the passages in Genesis 1, it doesn't say he created these things and it was day one. He created the next thing and it was day two. No, he created these things, and then it says the night and the day, or daytime, were one day. Now, people try to argue against this being a 24-hour time period, and I argue that it is a 24-hour time period. Here's why. It is specified nighttime, specified daytime. That is a 24-hour time period. So, therefore, I argue that God created everything in seven literal days. So what we have here is God creating things in time, which means God has to operate inside time. But that's not the only place that we see God operating inside time. Does someone want to turn to Genesis chapter 18, verses 12 and 13? Genesis 18, verses 12 and 13. And when you get there, you can go ahead and read it. So here we have the story of God interacting with Sarah and Abraham. He tells Abraham and Sarah that they're going to have a child. Sarah famously laughs. And some people have said that this was a laughter of disbelief. I tend to think of it as a laughter of overjoy and just like, wow, really? Wow. Just that kind of a laugh. But whatever the reason, we have Sarah laughing. So Sarah laughs. If we keep reading, Sarah laughs. The Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? So Sarah laughs. God responds. In order for God to respond, that response must come after the laughter, which means God is operating in time. We also have God dealing with Job inside time. We have in chapter 38, verse 1, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, then the Lord answered. That happens in time. Again, responding to something that happened beforehand. Chapter 40, verse 1, and the Lord said to Job, chapter 40, verse 3, then Job answered the Lord and said, 3 verses later in verse 6, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said. So, what's interesting in Job, especially chapter 40, is we have God spoke first, God said some things. In verse 3, Job responded to God, said his things. Well, then God responded back to Job. We have a conversation going on. That means God is not operating in this case outside of time, because otherwise, well, God could have said this before Job or after. No, no, no. He's interacting with him in time. Now, if someone want to turn to Daniel chapter 3, verses 24 and 25. So we have these men in a fire. They're standing there in the middle of this furnace that killed Nebuchadnezzar's guards. And then, so we have in the names that they were given in Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Don't ask me to cite their Hebrew names. I don't recall them off the top of my head. But then we have this fourth guy in there. Now, Nebuchadnezzar says, like the son of the gods, because they were polytheistic, we would say, no, he's not like one who is like the son of God. He is the son of God. This fourth person we now know as Jesus Christ. It's a pre-incarnate Christ. So here we have God the Son in the fire with these other three other men. God's operating inside time. Or you can put it this way, as Mr. Lunt said in VeggieTales, he's real shiny. So we again have God operating in time. And of course, we also have four books that outline God the Son operating in time a lot. He was born, he was raised, he went to the temple and befuddled the people, and amazed them. He lived, he taught, he died, he rose again in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Again, God operating inside of time. And some other verses that teach God that God acts in time in Galatians 4, verses 4 and 5. Now, these aren't instances of seeing God act in time or instances of God showing himself acting in time. These are more descriptions of that fact that God does act in time. In Galatians, Paul writes, but when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law so that we might receive adoption as sons. When the fullness of time had come, which means on the timeline, we have creation and then all the way until whenever. God waited and waited and waited and waited. Now it's time, which means God was acting inside of time. Now, Acts 17, verses 30 and 31. Does someone want to read Acts 17, verses 30 and 31? We have God saying that he's overlooked this. He has overlooked certain times. Now, he can do this outside of time. However, there's an indication that he's working in time because it says that he set a specific date. And right here, he set the specific date known as Judgment Day. That's fixed in time, which means God is going to be doing this in time. God set something in the calendar of time. God is acting in time. And also, what's interesting here is there's three things going on. In the times of ignorance, God overlooked. So we have God outside of time here, God acting in the past. In times of ignorance, he overlooked, but now he commands, so present, now he commands people to repent. And then he says, because he has fixed the day, the future. We have all three there, past, the present, and the future. Then God's operating in all of them. Now, God exists outside of time, but he operates inside of time. But he has something that we don't have. He can go back and forth and does do both. We cannot. We are always going to be bound to time. We are always going to be operating inside time. There will not be a time, lack of a better term, when we are outside of time. So I have written down there, although God exists outside of time, we're finite creatures. We're created in time and exist in time. Genesis 1:1 and then 26 to 31, because it's longer, I'll go ahead and read it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Then God said, this is jumping to verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let him have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. I guess we're supposed to have dominion over those spiders. I still won't mess with them. So God created man in his own image, in the image of God. God, he created him, male and female, he created him. Wait. He created them male and female? He created them male and female. You mean God didn't wait to ask Adam and Eve, so what do you want to identify as? No. He created male and female, and it is still male and female to this day. Why? Because that's what God created. Continuing on, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the earth and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. So, aside from the fact that God created man and gave him dominion, what we have here is the aspect that we were created on a specific day, which means that we were created inside of time. We have never existed outside of time, and we never will exist outside of time. Now, the question can come up, what about in the end with the new heavens, the new earth, and eternity? Will we exist outside of time then? And I've heard people argue that we will exist outside of time, and I've heard people argue that we won't exist out of time. I've often gone back and forth because I've been trying to wrestle in my own mind, which is it? The problem that people have with time is, you know, if you have a calendar, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, and so forth, all the way till the 12th month. Well, that's a long time. We're counting on days. But that can seem like a long time. Now, 70 years, that's a long time for some people. Imagine someone had lived nowadays for 150 years. That's a long time to live, isn't it? Well, now we just go further and further until we get to infinite time, where one day after another. And people look at the book Revelation and they see praising God. That's what it's about, praising God. And they're like, we have to sit there day after day after day after praising God. That's going to get boring after a while. No, it won't. But that's one of the main arguments I've heard against it, is that it's boring and it's forever. God wouldn't torture us to make us do this for day after day. So therefore, we have to exist in a single moment and outside of time. And, well, I can understand the philosophical and even the human argument against being in time and eternity. Well, let's take a look at Scripture. Revelation 21, verses 24 and 26. Revelation chapter 21, verses 24 and 20 through 26. When you get there, go ahead and read it. What some people point to here is the fact that it says, and there will be no night there. Ergo, no night, no time. However, that's not necessarily true. We can actually see examples of that in the natural world. Anybody ever been to Alaska? Yeah, there are some days when the sun does not fully go down. So there are places on Earth where there is no night, yet time still goes by. There's still time. Also, when you take a look at this passage, we have, by its light, the nations will walk, okay? So they're proceeding or existing in the light, and this light is the light of God. And the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it, and the gates will never be shut. They will bring into it the glory and the honor of the nations. What's subtle in here is this idea of things happening one after another, things happening in a order. That indicates there's time. But that's not the clearest of passages. I'll admit that. That's not the clearest of passages because it can be interpreted as no time because of the no night claim. No night statement. So we go upwards of the chapter to Revelation 22, verse 2. Through the middle of the street of the city, also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. So we have, this is in the new heavens and new earth, we have this tree that's bearing little fruits. Don't know what kind of fruit. I guess it looks like weird cherries today. So we have a holy cherry tree. And George Washington cannot get to it with his axe. But we have a fruit tree that it says it produces its fruit each month. 12 fruit. So we have here a statement of time. So we have something happening in time, in eternity, meaning after the physical life here. So in the end, after we leave this mortal coil, when we exist with God, we will still exist in time with God for a time that never ceases to exist. It will be an unending time. Instead of having you've seen various countdown clocks, well, there won't be one. So we'll have now through time to infinity. And we will exist inside time, and God will relate to us inside of time. Now, the reason I do not believe it will ever be boring or dull is because, well, one, we're going to be with God. And as great as God is, we're always going to have something more to learn. Also, being in the presence of God is so glorious, I'm convinced that we will forget everything else. And here's part of why I say that. When Isaiah was confronted with God, he fell on his face. He forgot everything else. He fell on his face. When John saw Jesus on Patmos, he fell on his face and fell down as if dead. Jesus told him to get up. Everything else he had forgotten. Nothing else mattered. Here was the risen Christ before him, and he fell down. And we see this over and over and over and over. When people encounter God in his full glory, or even in a partial glory, because I don't believe even at Patmos Jesus was in his full glory, because God said that if we can't see his face or else we'll die. The idea is we can't see his full glory in our human sinful eyes because it will kill us, because that's how glorious he is. When we see God, nothing else will matter. So will it be boring? No. Will we care what's going on around us? Probably not. We're going to be too busy being with God, glorifying Jesus. Now, will we recognize each other? I suppose so. I don't know. I can't say absolutely. I believe so, and here's why. I believe that we will recognize people. At the Transfiguration, Jesus was there. Some of the apostles were there. Two other men were there, Elijah and Moses, I believe. Now, they didn't have pictures back then. Yet the apostles looked at Jesus and said, by name, that person and that person. They named them. They'd never seen them. These guys didn't come and say, hi, by the way, I'm Moses. No. No introductions, and they recognized them. Based on that, I believe that in the new heavens and new earth in heaven, we will recognize each other. We will even recognize people we've never physically met. Because like Elijah and Moses and Abraham. Now, despite what some, I'll be nice, wackos say, no, we will not be seeing Superman and riding pterodactyls. Yes, some people. There's one lady who said that we'll ride pterodactyls. But we will recognize each other, but we will exist inside of time. And so we have to remember that although we'll exist for eternity with God, we'll exist inside time because we are finite creatures. We cannot exist outside of time. We cannot say for humanity, where you have the timeline and God exists outside of it, looking down at time, we exist here and always will. We will never be able to exist up here outside of time and see the past, present, and future as one single moment. We're always going to exist in time because we are created as finite creatures in a finite world, but we will live as finite creatures for eternity in time, and that's where our finiteness comes into eternity. We are not able to go beyond time. So we will exist with God, and God will, as he's done in the past and as he does now, he will operate inside of time along with us. But if we go to Revelation 21, verses 4 through 8, we see this. And this is relevant because although we're finite beings, and therefore we cannot exist outside of time, the eternity that we will experience will be, and this is where it gets into the glorification of it, a restored creation. It says in verses 4 through 8, he, referring to Christ, or God, or the Godhead, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. The former things here refer to the consequences of the fallen world. All of that is gone. And he who was seated on the throne, referring to Christ, said, behold, I am making all things new. And he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. And he said to me, Jesus said to John, it is done. Now that sounds familiar. Jesus saying it is done. He said that now to John. And John, by the way, was the apostle, the only one who was at the cross. So he would have been there to hear the initial, it is finished. Bit of a theological lesson here. The connection between it is done and it is finished. When Jesus said it is finished on the cross, he was talking about the work of atoning for sin. Salvation regarding the atonement and satisfying God's wrath is finished. His blood has now been shed. No more shedding of blood is necessary to pay for sin because it is finished. However, salvation itself as a total picture biblically begins at the cross. But you remember, Jesus is the author and finisher of our faith. Part of salvation is sanctification. The spiritual growth, as we might call it. And we grow, and at the final, that's my best chair. It's a throne. The judgment seat. At the judgment seat, in the very end, the sanctification process will then be complete. So, again, the work of atonement is finished. The absolute final work is done. So we continue on. It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of water of life without payment. That kind of goes back to the woman at the well. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. Here it is, Jesus claiming to be God. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. Oh yeah, so by the way, he just put liars in there with murderers. I'm not that bad. I've only told a few lies. I'm not a murderer. You're just as guilty, worthy of hell. It's right there. But the thing that we need to see here is this. In this eternal state, that which taints creation, that which corrupts us, all of it gone. No more death, no more suffering, no more sorrow, eternal glory and joy beyond our imagination. It's what Adam and Eve, I believe, got to experience until they ate. Untainted, uncorrupted world. and they ruined it for the rest of us. But we're not innocent because we all ruin it in our own ways too, because we all still sin.